football on off the ball.
Qualifying for World Cup was amazing. Compared to my child, Diego was for me, it's the best feeling in the world. No one ever topped that. Like, but it was important that I came back and refocused and really tried to get this league over the line.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Coigig Pod on Off the Ball in association with Cadbury, official snack partner of the Republic of Ireland women's national team.
Katie McCabe, a huge, huge goal.
Very proud of the team's performance.
We're going to go out there to beat them. We're going to try and beat them.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Coigig Podcast. Kathleen McNamee here with you to take you through all the happenings here in the world of football and also across the water in England in the WSL. Joining me as ever is Karen Duggan and Scarlett Heron. How are we doing, guys?
Very well, thank you, Kathleen.
Did you have any nice Halloween celebrations, Scarlett, or any fun costumes over the weekend?
We actually had a team party last night at one of the apartments, and me and one of the girls dressed up as Smurfs. So there you go.
Ah, very nice. Did you go for the full body paint and everything?
Oh, like full send, yeah.
Yeah. I'm quite impressed that you look reasonably okay today. I feel like when people go for those costumes, it takes like a day or two for the paint to wear off.
Yeah, I woke up and kind of like looked like I was just ill. Like, I might get like bits of blue spotted everywhere. So no, I think a shower this morning definitely helps. So I think I'm fully back to myself now.
How I looked after a normal night out on Saturday.
You didn't need any of the face paint or anything.
Looking ill after a night out these days.
Just one of the fun facts of getting old, Karen.
Yeah, I am testament to that.
Well, sure, look, at least you're not Mary Earps after this weekend. I feel like she's getting a lot of blowback after she released her autobiography specifically. I think it's kind of interesting how many of the journalists are very smug about it, because it's not a case where her quotes have been taken out of context in any place. It's literally just people reacting to exactly what she wrote and how she talked about Hannah Hampton and saying that they had a really difficult relationship and feeling like that Hannah Hampton was being praised for bad behavior. And when you consider the sort of success that Mary Earps had and like what a great redemption story it is, you just wonder why someone in her circle wasn't like, gal, maybe we need to reframe this a little bit.
I know, but she's all about the kind of like authentic self and all that sort of stuff. So she probably felt like she was leaving out an era or a chapter if she did that. It hasn't landed very well, to be fair. But at the same time, before these kind of excerpts or this conversation started happening, I would have had no interest in reading her book. And now I'm a bit like,
I'd pick that up.
Maybe, like, you know, she was on a train journey. If you want to sell books, you have to have that sort of stuff. Like, especially, we don't see that a huge amount of it in the women's game, like an autobiography selling and landing and causing a stir. So, I mean, maybe it did what it was supposed to do from her publishing team's point of view. But based on her statement afterwards, yeah, it's a bit.
There's also a part of me, though, that's like, we all know goalkeepers have egos. Like, you kind of need to have an ego to play that position, because, you know, if you don't, you're not going to get to the top of your game. You have to be able to command a back line. You have to be able to kind of, I don't know, basically make sure that everyone around you doesn't feel as good as you do in a certain moment so that you can keep that number one position and not just be a bench warmer for your entire career. So I'm like, are people surprised that Mary Earps has a bit of an ego about herself and thinks she was great?
Well, I'm not really surprised that a sub keeper might have a bad attitude, because it is the worst place in the world to be, because there's often times where you never envisage yourself getting a game and you're like, oh, what's the point working as hard? Only Hannah Hampton is absolute quality. Like, again, we saw it at the weekend, some of her distribution and the passes only she can do. You know, in the women's game, she is an unbelievable goalkeeper. So, look, I enjoyed the bit of drama. We all need a bit of drama. But yeah, it'll sell. It will sell this controversy. Yeah, it might be causing her pain now, but it will sell extra books. So you have to risk and reward.
Yeah. I just think it's a really funny arc of, you know, people seeing her as like an innocent, and she won like the BBC Sports Person of the Year and was seen as saving women's football because she gave off about the jersey incident with Nike. But I'm like, all these things point to her having an ego. Her being like, why can't people buy my jumper or my jersey is also like,
I think that's a really accurate reflection. Why would we be surprised that a goalkeeper who has had this kind of story where she's come up and then all of a sudden it dropped off and it was Paris over United and it was, I'm changing the world a little bit. Why would we be surprised? Yeah, I think you've made a really good point there. Yeah.
I think people have been a bit sensitive about it. I won't lie. All things considered, you know, I don't think Hannah Hampton is going to necessarily be shaking in her boots. She's England's number one goalkeeper. She's doing what she's doing at her club level. You know, she's going to see what Mary Earp says and go, nah, like, I'm number one now. You're
like Glamour Woman of the Year or something there the other day as well. I think she's.
Yeah, exactly. And like winning like trophies at the Ballon d'Or and things, you know, things are going trending her way a lot more than they are Mary Earp's at the moment.
If anything, so this has helped her.
Yeah, probably. Usually, it kind of
generated more support for her, which is, you know, people are fickle.
Oh, they are. They are indeed. Scarlett, you were looking at some of the other places where women's football fans weren't all that happy, and that was with these kickoff times at the weekends, which tend to see several matches kick off around midday, or else every single game kicking off at the same time, which is making it harder to watch matches, and also it's just not particularly accessible time for a lot of people, you know, whether you have been out of a night beforehand and you're not quite feeling up to watch the football at midday, or you're one of those sporty types that has games or training on at that time. It's kind of making the WSL a little bit more difficult to watch this year.
Yeah, and I think there's a good bit of chat about that this week. And as you said, people highlighting, you know, midday on a Sunday is quite a busy time for some people, and then for others they mightn't be up for it. But yeah, I think it's difficult. I understand what they're trying to do with it. Like, you see a few times when there's maybe no men's game on at that time, they'll do a multi-view on Sky, which is great because you can watch all four games kind of at the same time, and it expands the screen when there's a highlight in one of the games. And it's a good initiative, and I can see what they're trying to do. But then if you're a diehard United fan and you're going to every one of their games, you're missing the three or four other games that are on a Sunday that you would have watched otherwise. So if the United game can kick off 12:30, Liverpool can play Everton at 3, and then whatever, Man City can play Arsenal at 5:30, you can see the logic behind that, sort of spreading them out so that the diehard WSL fans, which have carried the league for a lot of years, can obviously get to see all these games. And as well, it's better for the casual fan as well if it's spread out. If you're a casual sports fan on a Sunday who's looking for something to watch and there's a game on at 12:30, 3:30, 5:00, you're a lot more likely to catch one of them than if they're all just on at 12 o'clock. So yeah, I can understand what they're trying to do, but then I wouldn't say that it's necessarily working out for them.
What is it that they're trying to do? Because I think a lot of fans don't really understand this and just see it as all the fixtures being placed into one particular time because it's the only time available, or maybe that there's no men's games or whatever it might be.
Yeah, well, we were talking about it, the Chelsea bias. They always seem to be playing on a Friday or Saturday, getting the Sky slot. So I suppose that frees up that time. But then for the other four or five maybe games on a weekend, they're probably just trying to highlight the multi-view thing. That's the only thing I can really see that they're trying to do from it. And like, it is a cool feature, and it makes our jobs a lot easier if you can watch the 12 o'clock game. But it's the same thing again. Like, if you miss one, you miss them all. And it's just, I'm not really sure, apart from that, what they're trying to get at with it, to be quite honest.
Yeah, it's not enjoyable. Karen, I know you've had your feelings about this before.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I do think they're right to stagger it away from the men's fixtures as much as possible. But there's surely a simpler way to do it. Even do a 12 and 12:30 if you need to, and have an extended show, and at least that way you can catch a game and a half or something like that. It's just, and like today I was trying to catch up on some of the games, and it took me ages to find, you know, the highlights and stuff of like the Liverpool game, which is like a important game for them, and like and what's going on with them. And you need to kind of see, are the, because it's easy to look at the table and look at West Ham and think, geez, West Ham are getting absolutely rolled over in all these games. But then you actually look at the games and you're saying, they're not really. Do you know, like, that just looking at the fixtures doesn't, or the results doesn't give you the full story. So to make it more accessible, I think they should go back to looking at potentially having a YouTube facility. I think that was like a live YouTube facility, and then we can all do our multi-device way, even if they have to keep it all at the same time. But I do love when the highlights pop up in screen. It's like, you know, red zone-esque. But yeah, it's just like Scarlett says, I think it makes it more difficult for the casual fan. I think, like you say, you'll get your Chelsea on TV, but if we want crossover from Spurs men's fans, when are Spurs going to be on TV to like highlight them and try and generate viewership and generate, you know, a fan base and stuff like that? So that's who it's affecting. It's affecting the teams that aren't being shown, in terms of giving them an opportunity to showcase themselves and, you know, develop in that way.
Yeah, I would agree.
Tricky one, because obviously Sky are doing amazing stuff and they've gotten brilliant panelists on and stuff. Like, we saw Megan Campbell was on there at the weekend. It's great to see her doing it. They're doing a really good job at what they do. It's just, yeah, it's alienating a little bit of an untapped fan base.
Yeah. And also, like, when you do have every game kicking off at the same time, like, no matter what sort of fan you are, even if there is that red zone style things, and some people don't like that. Some people are like, I just want to concentrate on the one game in front of me. It can just make the experience a little bit more difficult. Or even, you know, sometimes you're just like chilling of a weekend and you want to watch a couple of different games and have the opportunity to watch one lunchtime and then later on in the evening, whatever it is. So it'll be interesting to see, does Sky change their approach at all as the season goes on, or maybe it's something that they reflect on at the end of the season. But to look at the football that did happen, and we will start with, as Scarlett pointed out there, Chelsea and one of their nice kickoffs to start the weekend. I feel like they start the weekend off a lot of the time, which I'm not saying there's any biases there, but I would question it. And they had a nice tidy 2-0 win over London City Lionesses. But again, you would have to say the progress that we've seen from London City from the start of the season to that game was definitely noticeable, Karen.
That was not a comfortable win for Chelsea. No. I know we say that a lot, but I think it was to do with London City and how they played. I think obviously Chelsea came a bit out of the blocks, but in after the first couple of minutes when London kind of got to the pace of the game, like, they played some really, really nice football. Like, I know she was in the WSL2 last year, but really when you watch Aslani, she is a player of quality, and you can see why she has generated the most chances in the league so far. She really like picks up brilliant spaces for them. I also thought, like, Goodwin, you know, for a young striker, she was in that, what I would call like the Chelsea backline, they are quite physically imposing. I thought she was causing them all sorts of problems when she got on a bit of a canter with them, and she had a chance in the 90th minute when it was 1-0. It could have been a completely different story, and I don't think you would have begrudged them. Now, when Chelsea turned it on, geez, they're just frightening when they do turn it on. But they're not clinical at the moment, and I suppose they have a lot of change and stuff like that. And it was really interesting the way they lined up, and looking at seeing Lucy Bronze and Carpenter together. I think that was a question that a lot of people had, given the start that Ellie Carpenter has made to the league. For me she's undroppable, but then is Lucy Bronze as well? Probably. So they found a way to make that work, and it paid dividends early with Carpenter getting on the score sheet. But yeah, like you say, give praise to London City Lionesses. Like, they were chasing and made a bit of a mistake for the second goal, and obviously great to see Sam Kerr back after a long-term injury. But bit more time. I think they've gotten the balance right between knowing how to defend and playing their style of football, and they're not getting overrun the way they allowed themselves early on in the season.
Scarlett, what did you think about this game?
Yeah, I thought it was not as comfortable as they would have hoped, but I think we said that every week about Chelsea. Sonny Mabasser seemed happy enough after the game, saying it was a positive result, but I thought they were caught a wee bit at the back. I thought the gaps were a bit wider than usual. I think that was probably from playing the three at the back system and kind of letting Carpenter and Baltimore in the first half kind of get forward. But yeah, I thought they were kind of caught out a few times with sort of balls through those gaps, and I thought Millie Bright was really caught for pace once or twice as well. Now nothing came of them, obviously, but it would be definitely something to look at just in that system. But overall, yeah, deserved win. Look, we're seeing London City win the games they are expected to win and lose the ones they're expected to lose. And as Karen said, like, they do have talent in that squad and they have players that can score goals. And to be fair, defensively, they were quite solid. Like, I know the last goal was a bit of a leaker with a bit of a mishap between the keeper. But overall, like, they're doing quite well. And I think you do expect that when they put such investment into it. But it's great that a team has come up from the WSL2 and is, you know, standing their ground, and they're not going to struggle at all this year, which is really impressive, and it's great to see as I said, a team coming up and doing well. So yeah, fair play to them, but again, Chelsea always find a way.
I was going to say, it felt very Chelsea-esque that they only had two attempts on target and those were the two that they actually got in the back of the net. But like, to be fair to London City, they did have a couple of chances on target as well.
Also the fact that, right, Baltimore set up the goal and you think, geez, she's going okay, but they recognised a little bit of a defensive weakness, like Scarlett said there, and then they could just bring on Neve Charles, you know, another England international. Like, it's just relentless, the people that they have. And obviously you've got Girma coming back now, and obviously she didn't get game time. But if we're looking at possible areas of weakness, and you're saying maybe Chelsea were done for pace at the back, once she's fit, that's an automatic solution that they have ready to go as well.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Karen, you mentioned there when we were talking about the 12 o'clock kickoffs or the kind of simultaneous kickoffs, that if you didn't watch a single West Ham game this year, you would just think they're rubbish, they're awful, they can't get points on the board. But again, you'd have to say the performance against City at the weekend was another one of those ones where they were unfortunate not to come away with something, or to, you know, maybe not a win necessarily, but like, you can't say necessarily that it was an absolutely dire performance, I suppose, against like one of the top teams in the league.
Yeah, this one, there was kind of two ways to look at it, because if you look at it from a West Ham perspective and you want to take the positives away, Boueki had a big chance, Assey had a decent chance after Morgan did some really good work down the right. But on the flip side, Man City had loads of chances and just were nowhere near the target. They were really off form. I think they had something like 18 shots and one on target, which is the goal, which is, a given the players they have on the pitch, it's not a good return. And you're looking at that saying, will that cost them in the end? But they've gotten over the line. Got over the line against Arsenal. I think they had another couple wins since then that have just been one goal wins, and they'll be happy to do that. They're doing a bit of a Chelsea on it in that way. So you give West Ham credit for only conceding one goal, given the kind of momentum that Man City had within the game. They had a lot of the ball. They had a lot of possession up high, but didn't really trouble West Ham enough. So maybe I think they were always creating chances, and conversion is still a massive problem, but to only concede one against Man City when they're in the dire straits that they're in, again, they'll try and take positives from it, but I keep waiting for there to be a turn for both West Ham and Liverpool, and it's bleak viewing from both at the moment. Look, the Man City scored a good goal, and Fujino is kind of stepping up. Like, she was the one that got that winner against Liverpool as well, which was, you know, a dramatic finish. And they had a bit of a penalty call as well. Man City, I think they'll be happy to plunder over the line as long as they're keeping tabs on Chelsea.
Yeah, I think you're right. And again, I suppose for with Arsenal kind of dropping off now, United are kind of the big competitors there in terms of keeping in touch with Chelsea.
I think that's all they'll do. I think they'll keep in touch, but I don't think they'll challenge Man City.
Do you think City could challenge?
I think they're best placed, yeah.
Yeah. Scarlett, what do you think about that in terms of what we've seen from City so far? And I suppose as well in terms of how they have performed. You know, they do have that one loss. So that's going to kind of keep them a little bit off the pace of Chelsea. Chelsea haven't had any losses so far this season, just the one draw. So there is going to be that little gap between the two of them. But do you think City are showing enough at this stage that they can keep touch?
Yeah, well, I think the most important thing is obviously they're winning these games. Like, it's kind of similar to Chelsea's side at the minute, just getting through it. But I think it's interesting, like we spoke about there, the Baltimore-Charles change at halftime and just the depth that Chelsea have. And then you look at Man City's squad depth at the minute with so many injuries. They made one sub at the weekend, and then you would recognise the name of four of the subs on the Man City bench. And apart from that, it's all academy players coming up who haven't played at the level at all. And you just do wonder, like, if they get unlucky one or two more times, like, they could be in trouble. Like, we've seen the likes of Iman Benny come in and do really, really well. And then obviously that's in place of the likes of Lauren Hemp. And then you have Greenwood coming back from injury as well. So there's a few players that they need to get back, I think, to be full strength again. But yeah, I think in terms of depth, I don't think they'll be able to challenge Chelsea. I think that they are still getting used to the new system there. And I've seen a few of the players chat about that before the international break. So it obviously is working for them. They seem to be a much more content squad than when they were last season under Gareth Taylor. So there's obviously a different sort of mindset within that group, which could help them. But I think in terms of depth, they've been unlucky a few times with injuries. And I think, I don't know if they have the strength in that team at the minute just to keep going. I don't know how long the streak will last, but they need those key players back from injury quickly.
Yeah, we've seen how much injury can decimate City teams in previous years.
The thing, they've fallen foul to that so often in recent times, and we've put them falling off the title challenge so often because of injuries, that we were waiting for them to do what Chelsea are doing. Like, they surely have a way of getting the funds. They're not stuck for a few pounds as a club as a whole. So again, it's just about emphasis on the women's team and who's in charge of that, who has the purse strings there.
Yeah, because it's been an interesting one, considering they were pretty much the industry leaders for a long time in the sphere. And as you say, not a club who are necessarily, you know, trying to turn a profit, or, you know, they're not in the same way that United have been, say, over recent years, or a club that doesn't have a very nice big fund from an unnamed country of choice that they can dip into. So it will be interesting to, and I think a lot of people had kind of thought that, like, the previous management had something to do with the buying and selling and how that was going, but it'll be interesting to see, does that change now?
Country, not exactly a stronghold in women's sports.
No, but, like, again, if you look at the way they set up City and, like, the way that Newcastle is being built now, they have actually thrown money where their mouths is, and they're building that massive new state-of-the-art training centre and stuff for the women. So yeah, the country themselves obviously have never been good when it comes to that, but when you're trying to sports wash these things, I suppose they have tended to lean in and give a bit of money to the women's side of things. Watch my passport be rejected now forever. To look at the other side of Manchester there, and Brighton 2, Man United 3. Nice little 5 goal game, which is what we like to see. I think we did say before the international break that this could be a fixture that would prove quite interesting. Now, that was before the news of Michelle Aguiman unfortunately doing her ACL during the international break, which is such a shame for her considering the year she was having, and a real shame for Brighton because she was throwing up the goals for them there. But it actually didn't make that much of a difference on the day, Scarlett, despite the loss. I think it will be a reassuring affair for Brighton fans.
Yeah, definitely. I think they didn't really get back into the game the way they'd liked. Obviously, they got the goal back from Kirby, but I think Man United did well to sort of keep that lead and keep them at bay as much as they could. I think like Man United were thoroughly deserving of the win. Like, they had so many chances, and it's just a matter of that clicking and taking them. I think Brighton had a lot of sort of last-ditch defending actions in the game, and United did well to sort of not get frustrated in that first half because it seemed like they were going to go in all square at the break, which would have given Brighton that bit of a boost. But good take by Terland at the end of the first half, and then Jess Park was just class. Like, you look at Man City now, we're just talking about them like that. United have been the better half of that swap. She was just unreal. And when you have a player like that, it just takes control in the game, kind of grabs by the scruff of the neck and says, right, let's make things happen here. She was just top class. And I think we're seeing this United team sort of, grow into that goal scoring threat. And then at the other side, something that we didn't expect from was to leak two really, really poor goals. Not a great day for Letizia at the back. I think those two goals should be looking at it, thinking she could do much better. And it's just a bit of complacency set in, I think, at the wrong times. But yeah, definitely, I think, deserved their win. Really, really controlled it, but wouldn't be happy with those two goals being let in.
Karen, you're nodding your head there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, like you say, that goal just before, a minute before halftime, like, it's the perfect time to score. We saw it with Ireland against Belgium. You know, you're on top, you're chasing, you're wondering, is the goal going to come? And then it finally does, and it just kind of settles you going into the dressing room. They were completely dominant in the first half. They allowed Brighton a little bit back into it in the second half. Like you say, really bad mistakes, uncharacteristic of Letizia, who had finally been given her chance centre-back for England during the week as well. And then that happens. But maybe a bit of fatigue setting in for her. Like, just mentally coming down from that after all the talk about her getting her chance there. But yeah, just talk about, I guess, Jess Park and stuff as well. Like, United are...
Should just have a Jess Park slot every week at this stage.
But we have to, because like, United are good at defending, and they get the numbers back, and then through Jess Park and through the width that the fullbacks kind of hold, it allows the midfield rotation to happen, and she always finds the space, and she's such a willing ball carrier that United are still a bit of a counter-attacking team, but through her, the final ball and the cohesion between her and Toon and the forwards, they're taking up better spaces, they're making better runs, and they're creating more chances. And like you say, they can be more clinical, but again, they scored three goals. It should have probably been a 3-1 game. Like, you know, they're kind of, like you say, it was a real bad goals to give away. But yeah, it was good. And yeah, United, they were good. You just don't want them to start showing any creaks at this point.
Getting complacent.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, because United doesn't feel like complacency. It's just like, oh, are they just not good enough? But, like you say, there was a lot of blocks that Brighton put their bodies on the line a lot in the start. Minami was caught out for Park's goal, but like, I don't think anyone would have begrudged. I think she would have found a way to get on the score sheet anyway, the game she was having.
Another team who are back to finding their form are Spurs, although it was against Liverpool, so I don't know how much that can count for these days, but an important win for them just in terms of keeping the momentum up that we've seen from them so far this season, and the fact that they had to rally a little bit to get the win as well at Brisbane Road. we talked a bit just before the international break about Gareth Taylor and his attempts to rally the squad, Scarlett, after the games, and it felt like the comments, when you compare it to, say, a manager like Martin Ho, who's also just come in relatively new to the squad, and I know they're facing two very different situations as teams, but just in terms of the motivating factors and working with a smaller squad, it seems quite stark when you see the two of them side by side.
Yeah, and like I was even listening to Martin Ho's interview after the game, and he's very calm, really, really sort of encouraging guy. And, you know, he speaks and he's not a big character, you know, but he just speaks with such like a presence that you just back him, you know, you back that he has that change room under control. And we've seen like the way they're playing, like it's a very exciting brand of football. Like they're going a lot more direct, you know, they're getting balls into good areas, into the box. And it's where we kind of seen Liverpool struggle. Holt had a really, really good game and had a lovely assist as well for the first goal, I think. But yeah, when you look at Gareth Taylor and you see some comments online, it's not looking good for him at all. To go from maybe 18 months ago looking at him, you know, a team that's competing in Europe, competing at the top end of the WSL, to now struggling to get a point with Liverpool, it's been a really stark downfall, and it's not going well for him. And I don't know if I can see him in that job much longer, to be honest, just with the way things are going. But yeah, Spurs didn't really let Liverpool get a hold in the game at all. Thought even their press was quite good at times, sort of when Liverpool did try to play out, you know, limiting them to getting inside of the opposition half. So yeah, impressed by Spurs. Obviously Liverpool got the lead, but after that I think it was all Tottenham.
Karen, you kind of get the impression when you see these two teams and the managers in particular that despite maybe being more new to English football and WSL in general, Martin Ho is much more willing to mix up his football and mix up his style for the players around him compared to Gareth Taylor, who seems to have a very, very set way of playing. And I know, you know, Liverpool haven't been without their woes this season in terms of starting out with a small squad. There's obviously a lot of tragedy around the squad in general, and also the fact then that they lost a couple of players just before the international break to ACL injuries, which just kind of compounded things. But you just feel like this is the time and a moment where you need someone to adapt and adapt quickly, and it doesn't seem like Taylor is going to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's a bit of the shades of Ruben Amorim, is it? Like, it's this is the way I want to play, and that's fine when you have those players that you had with Man City. That is not the case with Liverpool, and that's not a slight on Liverpool. Their squad is not strong at the moment. They need to play to their strengths, because I don't really know what the strengths are at the moment, but they need to acknowledge that they're in a precarious position and do what Leicester did and find a way to get a point here and there to like kickstart your season. And look, there's going to be a bit of grace at the end of the season because you do go into a playoff, but does anyone really want to be there? No, obviously not. I think you're right. I think it's a matter of parking ego, because I'm sure, like, I've heard that the sessions are good. Like, he is probably an excellent coach, but in terms of getting the best out of your players, there has to be a change, because I don't know what you made of the comments. The comments was that we're showing things in glimpses, but we can't sustain it because of various factors. Like, what are the various factors? Is it fitness? Is it just don't have players spring off the bench? Like, what are the various factors? Because if he was more transparent, maybe in the interviews and stuff, if he says that,
yeah,
there'd be a bit more leniency online, because I'm sure in the background he's working just as hard as any manager.
Mm.
Again, he'll have come from success. He took on a WSL job again because he feels he can make an impact there. So it's a tricky one, because to face backlash when we don't know what the various factors that he is referring to are, it's a tough one to try and generate some goodwill from.
I think this is something that you said quite consistently about him, that if he was a bit more open and honest about those factors, you know, if you did say, look, we have a ridiculously small squad, or we lost two of our starters before the international break, or, you know, the team is just mentally not in a great spot, which, again, all of those are like very understandable excuses because they're all absolutely accurate, I'm sure. But it's the vagueness, yeah, of what he's saying. And maybe he's looking at it as he's trying to protect the players a bit and he sees it that way.
I'd say that's it. I do think there's an element of that. He's not getting the best out of their players because maybe they're not in the right space to give him their best at the moment. And yes, they have some time to turn this around, but like the fall from where we thought that Liverpool would start, you know, making moves towards the top four or five at least, that seems like a lifetime ago now, and it was two seasons.
Yeah, it really does seem like many, many moons ago. Scarlett, looking at the other Liverpoolian side, Everton, and they managed to snatch a point with a 94th goal from Kelly Gago, so that it ended up being 3-3 in a very entertaining game against Aston Villa. The second half in particular was particularly end-to-end. An interesting game for Everton in the sense that obviously they had the wherewithal to be able to get that last minute equaliser, pull themselves back up. Then you had the unfortunate part of the own goal from Ruby Mace. And also, like, they had so many chances that you would kind of feel that maybe it shouldn't have been left until the 94th minute for them to have to bring it back around.
Yeah, I think it's one of those games where both teams would probably think they should have got the 3 points. I think Everton probably one of the best performances we've seen from them in a while. You know, they had bright periods, and when they did, they took full advantage and scored during those periods. And yeah, I don't think Villa would be too happy with it. Obviously, probably started off with sluggish in the game, went 1-0 down early on, and took the best part of maybe 35 minutes to actually get a foothold in the game. And then obviously, yeah, the late goal by Gago is just poor defending as well. Like, it's not reactive enough. It's disappointing from them. And I think for Everton's point of view, I think Gago and Payne were really, really good. I think we spoke about them a good bit on the pod, and you know, that's their bright sparks. Like, that's the bright sparks in that team. And if they can both click and have a good game, you know, you're gonna be thereabouts in terms of trying to get a point or 3 points in a game. So I think a lot more positives to take from an Everton fan than a Villa fan. And even Aurora was saying after the game that, you know, not happy with the performance, very, a bit much so off it, and just starting too slow in the game, and then sort of relying on, you know, a goal like the Ruby Mason goal to sort of put you ahead late on, and then not being able to hold on to it as well. When, you know, that's a valuable 3 points gone for them that they could have got a hold of if they, you know, you're just lock up at the back and stay defensively tight and solid and just clear your lines. But yeah, entertaining game to say the least, but probably a fair enough result.
And then Karen, Arsenal are back to winning ways, 3 wins in all competitions. No, the league is obviously gone from them at this stage, so
that's negative.
Well, it is. Like, you can't lose the amount of games that they have and be that far off, like 5 points off Chelsea, unless Chelsea and City and United and arguably Tottenham as well all go into meltdown. You would have to say it's looking very unlikely, but it's all right because Ireland or Dublin is going to win the bid for the Champions League final in, is it 2 years' time, 3 years' time? And Katie's going to come back and win it here as well, and we'll all be happy and fine, and I'll forget all these terrible seasons that we've been the nearly women / completely off the pace in the WSL. An important win going into a big, big game at the weekend against Chelsea, because whatever about me saying that the league is gone, that's the sort of game that you have to win if you want to stay in any way competitive for the rest of the season.
Well, look, it would change the complexion of things completely, and we'd all be grateful for it, because we'd feel like it was opening up a little bit, you know, the league, that Chelsea just won't go on to do what Chelsea do. It really would close the gap there. But Arsenal, they played really well. Obviously, Leicester have their limitations, and you know that sometimes they can stay in a game, sometimes they can't. But I think Arsenal started off really well. Obviously, made more changes again. This time they worked. Mead was brought back in. She was involved in an awful lot. She crossed the ball in for Blackstenius for the first goal, who kind of just got a touch on it, and then it landed to Russo, who slammed it home. And again, as much as Blackstenius misses a lot of chances, when they have Russo in the 10, I think it just sparks something a little bit in terms of just the directness that she brings, her the way she holds up the ball. And yeah, Blackstenius missed a couple of chances, but she also scored, and Russo was, there was really good link up between Russo, Mead and Blackstenius, I felt. Which goal was it? The
third one, was it?
Third goal, yeah. I mean, the third goal was amazing. That started from the left back position, went out to the right wing position, and all the way through for the Blackstenius finish. And again, it was Caldente at the back to Russo, Mead involved, Blackstenius. It was a really, really good team goal. So when they're firing, it's a beautiful thing to watch. It's just about consistency for them now.
Mm. Justice for Caldente not being recognised by all her fellow footballers in the team of the year.
Crazy. Crazy when she was in the conversation for Ballon d'Or.
Yeah. She literally came second in the Ballon d'Or vote, didn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, just injustices against Arsenal players, you know. It's just the poor, suffering club that we have to go through all these. Karen and Scarlett, thank you very much for everything as always. We'll be back next week for more assessment of the WSL, in particular that Chelsea Arsenal game, and also we will know our League A opponents by that time for the Ireland national side, so we will have a little bit of reaction to that. I actually won't be watching Arsenal Chelsea live because I'm going to the rugby, and I'm being a terrible supporter and changing allegiances for one afternoon only, but I will do my best to catch up depending on what the scoreline is. If it's like 6-0 to Chelsea, we'll I may up. Just ignore it.
We'll keep you up to date.
Yeah, yeah.
Firing, you'll know that they're not doing well.
Yeah, exactly. The Quigging Pod and Off the Ball is brought to you by Cadbury, official snack partner to the Republic of Ireland women's national team. Thank you all very much for listening, and we will see you again next week.
The Quigging Pod on Off the Ball in association with Cadbury, official snack partner of the Republic of Ireland women's national team.